And now it's my pleasure to introduce Julia Hauserman. Julia is an international human rights lawyer and development worker. She set up Rights and Humanity, an international civil society organization, 22 years ago. And over two decades, her thought leadership has helped shape global policy and practice. She played a critical role in embedding respect for human rights and dignity into the global response to HIV/AIDS. She works tirelessly to get fundamental human rights out of legal treaties and into the daily reality of people's lives. In 1996, she was instrumental in ensuring the integration of such essentials as the rights to clean water, sanitation, healthcare, education, and livelihoods into the South African Constitution. This human rights approach to development, which Julia has pioneered, has now been adopted by the UN and other development groups around the world. Her consensus-building skills have been called upon to resolve deadlocks between governments within the UN. That must have been interesting. And to build bridges of understanding and cooperation between people of different faiths and cultures. In 2001, she was honoured by Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II with the award of an MBE, the recognition of her services to international human rights. So an extremely impressive CV. And now it lies with me to invite you to speak. Julia.
Well, thank you very much. And what a joy to be with you all this afternoon. So happy 60th anniversary to the Universal Declaration.
We should have a cake, shouldn't we?
Yeah, we definitely should. Well, I would like to start by saying that I don't see any conflict between spirituality, human rights, and democracy. Quite the reverse. I nail my flag firmly to the mast and say that I think they are mutually reinforcing and essentially interwoven. The second thing I wanted to say before I expand on my presentation is that in discussing the balance between human rights and responsibilities, sometimes people think that you lose your human rights if you behave irresponsibly. The classic example people will give, for instance, is a murderer, and say, well, if you're a murderer, you've clearly not behaved responsibly, and therefore you have no rights. I challenge that. And in fact, that's not what international human rights law means. What it is true to say is that if you commit a criminal act, you may have part of your liberties and freedoms restricted. You may be sent to prison. But your fundamental human rights and dignity remain intact. So there is not a causal link between them. You do not lose your rights if you're irresponsible. You still have the right to health care in prison. You still have the right not to be tortured. You still have the right, even if you're an asylum seeker who's been turned down by the government, with the right to stay, you still have the right to be treated with respect and in accordance with your fundamental human rights. These rights are inalienable. They cannot be taken away. And that is absolutely firmly the line of international human rights law. So I just wanted to mention that right at the very beginning. But I thought in this very interesting topic I've been asked to speak about, which is the balance between human rights and responsibilities and a crisis for our citizenship, I thought I'd start by asking, well, what are the human rights that we have in Britain as citizens of Britain? And I'll refer, if I may, just to some of the legal documents that Dominic mentioned in passing. But firstly, in Britain, of course, as we know, we have the Human Rights Act now. And the Human Rights Act introduced into UK law the provisions of the European Convention on Human Rights, which was adopted in 1950 after the war. But that particular document only protects civil and political rights. So there is a current debate in Britain at the moment about a Bill of Rights which will expand the legal protection in Britain to include perhaps economic, social and cultural rights. But just because they're not written into UK law doesn't mean to say we haven't got those rights. The British government has ratified the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights. It is held accountable to the UN body that monitors compliance with the covenant, and therefore technically we are entitled in Britain to those rights protected in that covenant. And I'm hoping very much that that will be corrected in the new Bill of Rights and economic and social rights will be brought into British law. But what does it mean to incorporate these rights in a Bill of Rights? In South Africa, after the fall of apartheid and the development of the new South African constitution, the Constitutional Assembly was debating these very same issues. The ANC, in its Freedom Charter back in the 1950s, had always endorsed economic and social rights, the fundamental rights to education, to livelihood, to health, to education, these basic essentials. But when it got into power, they suddenly got cold feet. They were concerned that to put those into the Constitution would somehow lead people to false expectations that overnight housing was going to be given to all, or that everybody was going to have access to healthcare instantaneously. And they got scared that it would bankrupt the government. And I had the great privilege of being invited to go and address the South African Constitutional Assembly to explain that actually that is not how they are perceived in the international law on economic and social rights. The obligation of the state is progressive realization. So it recognizes we can't overnight get rid of starvation. We can't overnight get rid of massive homelessness or poverty. But the government does have an obligation to take steps towards the progressive realization. So in the debate in the UK here, I would like to suggest that they adopt a similar stance as the South African Constitution has, which is that you recognize these as fundamental rights, and the obligation of the government is to work progressively towards the full realization for everyone of these rights. There's an alternative proposal, which is to introduce these rights not as legally enforceable rights that you could go to court to have enforced, but as more directive principles shaping government policy. I think that's a watered-down version, and it's certainly not one that I would wish to recommend in Britain. But it was the approach that was taken by India. But India was way, way, way ahead of the rest of the world by introducing this branch of rights into their constitution 40 years ago. And what has happened in India is very informative, because the legislation is in place saying that it's directive principles, but the cases being taken to the Constitutional Court have developed in such a way that the court now treats these rights in exactly the same way as it treats civil and political rights. In other words, it allows people to go to court and challenge a policy that has prevented food being distributed in times of need. And so I think it would be a retrospective step in Britain if we used it simply as directive principles. The world has moved on. Let's be ahead of the game instead of behind. So what are our responsibilities then? If we have these rights in British law, and hopefully the new Bill of Rights will firmly state that we have those fundamental economic and social rights, what are our responsibilities as citizens? I think this is where sometimes the arguments get a little confused. Because when we start talking about responsibilities of active citizens, it isn't the other side of the coin to the human rights that we are talking about. And unless you're talking about the right to vote, then your duty as a citizen might be to take an active part in the political process. But when you're talking about the right to health care, I don't have a duty to... Well, what is my duty? And this is where sometimes there gets some obfuscation, if I can say such a word, because we sometimes start thinking in terms of having a right to health care, then implying a duty to protect my health. And if we go down that line, you can see where we're going. You'd be starting to refuse treatment to people who have cancer through smoking, refusing treatment to people who may have had a drink problem, and so forth. It is not the route we wish to go, is it? I'm sure it isn't. So if we can remember that human rights are inalienable, you can't see them just as the mirror of obligations, of the mirror of rights. The mirror obligation of the rights is the duty on the state. But that isn't to say I don't have any duties as a citizen. It's quite interesting, when I was preparing for this, I looked up duties of citizens or responsibilities of citizens on Google, the main information source for most of us, I'm sure. And the fascinating, all of the links took you to America. In America, this debate is clear. It's clear what your responsibilities are. They've been defined. They've been they're taught in schools. There are whole websites on it and so forth. If you look for what are the citizens' responsibilities in Britain, you find that there's very little written. I found a very useful comment on the website of the British government. It simply said, as a British citizen, you have, of course, your responsibilities. And you're obliged to comply with your duties as a citizen. But trying to define them has become much more complicated. And I'm sure that many of you are aware of the debates that are currently going on about citizenship training in schools, about the possibility of a new oath of allegiance, of all of these things, particularly tied up with immigration. But because we find it difficult to define what our British values and responsibilities are, that debate is very murky, I think. But I think what we can say, and this is where I think spirituality is so important, is that fundamentally we do all recognise that we have responsibilities at some level to society. And I think we can today say that we clearly recognise we have a responsibility to the environment. So although the responsibilities we have may not be the mirror image of the rights that we're claiming, we certainly have them, don't we? And I think we all recognise that. I was talking to a friend in Liverpool who was very sadly personally affected by that stabbing recently. The young boy actually came to his youth centre and tried to escape the attack and died on his premises. And I was talking about the arguments I'm hearing in the press now about the duty of parents and communities to tackle the gun culture, the knife culture. And he said to me, "Oi, oi, 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 just wait a minute, please, before you go any further. Remember that the people who are affected by this are already the least able to cope. The people who are suffering on a day-to-day basis in poverty in Toxteth or Everton, where this event took place, they've already got enough on their plate. Don't start giving them the responsibility of policing the knife culture. This is, it's unfair to put it on the parents, and it's a shared responsibility of the whole of society." So I think when I first started talking about responsibilities in human rights, my NGO colleagues got very worried and told me that we shouldn't be going down that line at all, because somehow by talking about individual responsibility, they feared that we were letting governments off the hook. So I put another caveat here, that when we're talking about the responsibility of citizens, that we don't put too much onto poor communities, poor groups, and expecting them to be able to tackle everything. It's a shared responsibility, the state, society as a whole, as well as the communities most directly affected. I wanted now to turn to a little bit, broaden the debate. I was looking at the question of what are our responsibilities as active citizens. But what are our responsibilities as human beings? And I think that is the profound question. Because we've talked about universal human rights. Dominic explained to us that the whole purpose of human rights is that they belong to every single human being, whether or not you're a citizen of any particular state. So when we claim human rights in Britain, we're claiming them not as citizens, but as human beings. So what are our equivalent responsibilities as human beings? And I think that this is much clearer. And certainly when you start involving our faiths and our spiritual understanding of the nature of the human family. In 2003, Rights and Humanity decided to try and encapsulate these fundamental responsibilities in the principles of responsibility of rights and humanity. And we worked with a group of people from different faiths and different backgrounds, different professional backgrounds and different cultures to try and articulate a set of very simple principles that would resonate with every one of us. In fact, I brought a few copies of them, of the principles of responsibility, which are on the table at the back if you would like to pick them up. But basically, we recognized that we have certain responsibilities which we share across our faiths and cultures. We have the responsibility to respect our common humanity. We have the responsibility to respect human dignity. We have the responsibility to revere life in all its forms, harking back to what Dominic mentioned to us. We have the responsibility to respect and protect the human rights of everyone, everywhere. We have the responsibility to think and behave with compassion, to act with integrity, and to make peace so that we can all live in unity. Now, those sort of responsibilities are something that everybody can recognize. And we have had very interesting comments back from people from many different cultures and faiths and from all over the world who recognize those as being fundamental values that they recognize within their own context. So when we're talking about then a balance between human rights and responsibilities, at that more universal or more profound level, what are we talking about? Again, I remind us that they're not dependent one upon the other, but certainly my right to swing my arm stops at Dominic's nose, doesn't it? My right to party till 4 o'clock in the morning stops when my neighbour needs to sleep. You know, there's an automatic balance in common sense, isn't there? So clearly, if I have rights, I also have responsibilities to respect your rights. And that is an automatic balance. But equally, I wanted to give a couple of examples of where I think the balance has worked very, very well. In Uganda, the government has taken very seriously the right to education. Many of you probably know this. And it is promoting education as one of its core priorities. But I heard, and I hope that this is true because I quote it quite often, I heard that they've gone a little bit further in terms of transparency and that the government says, it announces publicly the amount of money it's made available for education in the budget. That is then translated into how much is received by each region. So the regional political office will have a sort of balance sheet on its door saying global budget for education in Uganda, XYZ, we got 50% of that, or 10% of that, that amounted to this amount of money, and this is how we're spending it. Then you follow that down to the school, and on the door of the school it says, this is the amount of money that was given to us, and this is how we're spending it. Now that, I think, is the wonderful balance of the responsibilities and the rights, all the way down the line. Another example I'd like to give you is in Mozambique, in a slum area in Mafalala that I visited when I was doing some work for UNICEF in 2004. And UNICEF has introduced a human rights approach to its work. And they were looking at how to protect the citizens from the people living in this slum area from the risk of disease through teaching them about the right to health and the right to water and the right to sanitation. And I think they made a great deal of progress, and there was a lot that was being done in that community. But what I found fascinating is when I started asking more deep questions and saying, do you understand what your own responsibilities are here? The people who were participating in our focus group said, oh, yes, we understand that the government has the obligation to supply the water, but we have an obligation to build the latrine. They have an obligation to collect the rubbish, but we have an obligation to take it outside the slum because the trucks that collect the rubbish can't get in because it's so narrow. So we have an obligation to take the rubbish to the outside. Now, that for me is a balance of rights and responsibilities, where people are working together to make the best possible outcome. But when we come back to the question of Britain, I think we might find that we're a little bit out of balance in our rights and responsibilities at the moment. And I think part of that is due to what you referred to, Dominic, the whole problem about the war on terror, so-called war on terror. Because I think this security issue has been allowed to infiltrate into the whole edifice of life in Britain, so that our rights are being reduced in the face of perceived security needs. I read a rather alarming article recently where it said that security issues was actually leading the police to police by ethnicity and religion rather than to police by any other evidence. So the presumption that somebody might be involved is very worrying. That goes way, way, way away from the fundamental essence of human rights that we've had in this country protected for so, so long. So what can we do about it? Well, I think we have to be vigilant. So to be an active citizen, I think we have a duty to defend human rights in Britain. I think we have a duty to use our democratic voice to air our concerns. If we then expand that to the global agenda, we are, of course, also global citizens. And in the times of global threats, climate change, outrages of poverty, HIV, AIDS, malaria, TB, all of these issues, our duties obviously are clear that we have to use our democratic voice, the rights that we have been given and that people over the centuries have fought so hard to secure for us. We have to be able to use that voice to stand up for human rights all over the world. And I think that is part of our responsibility, that we really have to be engaged as much as we can. Many people are doing many things. We changed our purchasing habits, buying fair trade, renewable processes wherever we can. But we have to, I think, really keep ourselves informed. And I was feeling a great sense of mea culpa, which I was expressing over lunch today, not knowing what was going on in the Congo until I read an article in The Independent yesterday. And it was complaining that the consumer society, and particularly the increasing use of mobile phones, was fueling the conflicts and wars that's going on in Congo, which is the main supplier of, I'm going to have to ask you again.
Coltan,
thank you. One of the minerals that's used in the mobile phone industry. Now, I didn't know about that. So I think our responsibilities are not just to act on the things we do know about, but also to keep ourselves informed. And there, of course, are lots of websites to do that. I wanted to end with two quotes, really. The first one was referring back to democracy, and it's Churchill's old chestnut that democracy is the worst form of government. except all those others that have been tried and failed before. But then I also heard that he might have said, if you want to argue against democracy, just go and spend 5 minutes with the average voter. I'd like to end with a wonderful poem, which takes us back, I think, to this understanding of us as human beings, as spiritual beings. And I think that when whatever we set our minds to doing, if it's working on human rights, democracy, climate change, whatever, the most important thing is to be congruent with our own deep fundamental beliefs. And that it's the power of that congruence when, to use Gandhi's phrase, we are, we be the change we want to see in the world. When we are that truth, then things, magical things happen. So I'll end with this wonderful poem from Ibn Arabi. My heart is open to all the winds. It is a pasture for gazelles and a home for Christian monks, a temple for idols, the black stone of the Mecca pilgrim, and the book of the Quran, the table of the Torah. Mine is the religion of love. Wherever God's caravans turn, the religion of love shall be my religion and my faith. And this is how we can fulfill Alice Bailey's understanding of us as one humanity. Thank you.